Good evening. It's good to see each of you tonight. Hope you all are doing well. We have many of our number who are sick and many who have had some procedures done and such over the last few days that we need to be praying for and seeing to. But it's good to see each of you tonight as we have our study this evening. If you would, please turn with me to Judges chapter 5. We've been studying the book of Judges, and it's a very interesting study as we look at this cycle that the sons of Israel are going through over and over again. And in Judges chapter 5, we've been studying the song of Deborah and Barak. And tonight, I believe, we'll be probably finishing the chapter. We'll be looking at the last several sections here and hopefully making some good application and making some good insight from the end of this chapter. We talked about in Judges chapter 5 that it has several sections to it and several things that are pointed out. And we talked about that there's several sections of the song that proclaim praises to the Lord for delivering them over Sisera and his army. Also, there are several sections that acknowledge individuals specifically. You think about Deborah speaks of herself. Barak is mentioned, obviously. Tonight we'll be talking about Jael is mentioned specifically. So there's specific individuals mentioned. Also, on Sunday morning, we talked about specific tribes being mentioned, tribes that volunteered and answered the call, and they were willing to go to battle, and then also tribes that didn't volunteer and didn't answer the call, I guess you could say, to go fight against Sisera. Also, we've studied the oppression that they were going through, the difficulties, and some of the things that they could have been going through during this time. Tonight, we're especially going to be looking at these last two points, where it discusses the battle with a little bit more detail than what you find in chapter 4 as far as a few things that are mentioned. And also this really interesting conclusion to the song where it discusses the thoughts, I guess you could say, of Sisera's mother as she's longing for her son and kind of her point of view from outside the battle, I guess you could say. So this is a very interesting section of the text. Right here, I have a map I wanted to show you that I think is kind of interesting, especially connected with what we discussed on Sunday morning. One of the things that I think you see in this map that's interesting is that it shows roughly the area in which the battle unfolded. And some of these places and some of these lands and these towns and villages, we're not sure exactly of the location. Some of them we do know the exact location. But what's interesting about this map is when you look at verses 15 through 18 that we studied on Sunday morning, what you see there is that it talks about the tribe or the divisions of Reuben, that they had great resolves of heart. It talks about also Gilead remaining across the Jordan in verse 17. And why did Dan stay in ships and Asher sat at the seashore? And what's interesting about when you look at a map and put that into context with the map in front of you, is that you realize that from the map, these groups that are here, they didn't get a pass card because of proximity to the battle. So if you look at where the battle unfolded, and you think about, well, first of all, you think about the tribe of Reuben. Well, Reuben is not actually on the map. Reuben would have been south of Gad, over here on the east side of the Jordan River, pretty far away from the battle, if you think about it. You think about Gilead is labeled over here on the far right side, right above Gad. So that's half the tribe of Manasseh and Gad is Gilead on the east side of the Jordan River. And so you can see they're on the other side of the river. You think about Dan is located over here on the bottom left on this western side over by the Mediterranean Sea. So they would have been south of the battle line. And then Asher was up toward the north. And so you see that some of these areas were actually somewhat close to the battle. Like you think about Asher, not very far away. But then on the other hand, you have a couple of these tribes that are on the other side of the Jordan River, maybe very far south. And regardless, Deborah and Barak in the song point out that they should have done something, that they didn't volunteer and they didn't participate in this battle when some of these other tribes obviously did and acted in faith. So I think it's interesting to kind of see that proximity didn't give anybody a pass as far as everyone should have participated and been a part of this. And it reminds you a great deal of when Joshua led them into the Promised Land and how the tribes participated together to try to take over these Canaanite areas. and that we're working much more as a team to try to do that. And I think that you see that camaraderie was meant to happen here. But there were certain tribes and certain people that didn't answer the call like others did. And so the map is an interesting thing I think you can look at to try to put that into context a little bit. Where we were when we finished class on Sunday morning is we were reading verses 19 through 23 of Judges chapter 5. And I'll reread that. In verse 19 it reads, "The kings came and fought, then fought the kings of Canaan. At Tanach, near the waters of Megiddo, they took no plunder and silver. The stars fought from heaven. From their courses they fought against Sisera. The torrent of Kishon swept them away. The ancient torrent, the torrent Kishon. O my soul, march on with strength. When the horse's hoofs beat, from the dashing of valiant steeds. Curse Meroz, says the angel of the Lord. Utterly curse its inhabitants, because they did not come to the help of the Lord, to the help of the Lord against the warriors." So as you look at this section of verses 19 through 23, I remember the last thing that I said before we dismissed class is we were talking about in verse 20, the stars fought from heaven. And I said, what do you think that means? Does anyone have any thoughts on that? No? No. God delivered him. Yeah, and what did God actually do? It was rain. Right. There a storm. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's the hand of God acting in battle. It connects a great deal with when you look back at verses 4 and 5, where it talks about the earth quaking or the mountains quaking at the presence of the Lord, the clouds pouring water or dripping water. There's a little bit of metaphorical language there, but it's just speaking again to the power and might of God and how God acted in a very powerful and mighty way by giving this great deluge of water. That made Sisera's army and his 900 chariots unable to overcome this. So it's very similar to the language there, I think, in verses 4 and 5, some of that type of language that's used. In verse 21, it reads that the torrent of Kishon swept them away. And you think about the Kishon River, it says the ancient torrent, the torrent Kishon. And we talked about earlier the location of the river Kishon and how you have Mount Tabor and then you have Harosheth, Hagoyim, and its position right in the middle of those two areas roughly. But this is the area in which Sisera's army was routed, and they had this great deluge of water. Many commentators say that the boundaries of this river would have overflowed to some degree, and so it would have caused these chariots to get bogged down in mud and not be able to travel, not be able to carry out what they were able to do. So it obviously caused a great problem here. But again, who caused the increase? Who caused this victory? It was God. I mean, that's really the point. And so this ties very well, I think, to chapter 4, reading of the battle. It ties very well to the first, or back to verses 4 and 5, speaking of some of the things about the battle and how God's mighty hand was definitely on full display. A really good point. Yeah, Kenny? I don't know. I will say this. This kind of segues into what I would say next. Who was the primary false god of the Canaanites? Or one of the main ones? Baal. All right. Baal was the god of what? God of fertility. God of rain. And that's true. And that's really interesting. The Canaanites depended on their false god Baal for providing fertile crops, for bringing the rain. They looked to him and worshiped him to provide those things so that they would have what they needed. It's interesting that God uses rain. I think that's just an interesting side note. To prove his power and might, that he's the one that controls the weather, it's no Baal. It's no false god that controls the weather. Yes, sir? That's right. Yeah. It's pretty amazing, isn't it? So God is using the exact thing that they believe their God has the power to control. And it also proved it to his own people, too, because the sons of Israel had participated in idolatry. And so they had their hearts taken away. And so he's proving it to them also that I am the God. I am the true God. And there is no one else that controls these things but me. And he was proving it to everyone. And I think that points out, goes to, like, you know, when Deborah's pointing out to all the kings of the earth, and she's pointing out to everyone around, from people who are noble, you know, proclaiming God, praising God. It's because he did a magnificent thing in revealing himself here with great power. In this verse 23, where it says, "Curse Meroz, said the angel of the Lord, utterly curse its inhabitants, because they did not come to the help of the Lord. To the help of the Lord against the warriors." This is somewhat an interesting thing here, and the reason why is because Meroz is only mentioned this one time in Scripture. It's believed to be a town or a village that existed during this time. But even now, they've done all kinds of searches and such, and some people, they suppose they know where it's at, but most people say we don't even know its exact location. Is that ironic that we don't know where it exists? Exactly. Exactly. It's not ironic at all. Because who brought this curse? This isn't a curse from Deborah, and it's not a curse from Barak. Who did the curse come from? Angel of the Lord. Yeah. And so it's recited in the song of Deborah and Barak, but it came from the angel of the Lord. And so it's not a surprise that you can't find remnants of Meroz. You can't figure out where it's at because it received what was its due. What did they do or not do? They didn't help. So you can partner them up if you want to, when you think about Reuben and you think about these other individuals, a part of these tribes that didn't act. They had the opportunity. It was put on their plate. And they decided not to volunteer and not to fight against Sisera. And it definitely seems to imply here that they could have done good here. They could have come to the help of the Lord. It doesn't even say come to the help of the people or the sons of Israel. You could have come to the help of the Lord to do what the Lord intended, and they didn't do it. And because of that, Meroz is utterly cursed, and their inhabitants are utterly cursed. And so, we don't know where Meroz is. We don't know where it's at. I think that's interesting. All right. Anybody have any comments before we move on? Yeah, Pax? Right. Mm-hmm. And you see that here. Yeah. Or lukewarmness. Yeah. You see in Reuben, you know, that they were having these conflicts apart. You know, you're kind of sitting there and you're going back and forth, you know, and it ended up that they were inactive and didn't do anything. I think that's true. Uh-huh. All right. In this next section, let's read verses 24 through 27. The thought transitions over to Jael and reminds us of chapter 4, the story of Jael and Sisera. And so let's read verses 24 through 27. "Most blessed of women is Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Most blessed is she of women in the tent. He asked for water, and she gave him milk. In a magnificent bowl, she brought him curds. She reached out her hand for the tent peg, and her right hand for the workman's hammer. Then she struck Sisera, and she smashed his head. And she shattered and pierced his temple. Between her feet he bowed, he fell, he lay. Between her feet he bowed, he fell. Where he bowed, there he fell dead. So as you get into this section here, it's quite the contrast of some of the individuals in the tribes that we read right before this, right? You think about, we just read of Meroz and how they're cursed for not doing anything and not acting in faith. You also read of Reuben and all these other tribes, Gilead, Dan, and Asher, who could have volunteered and been active, and they didn't. And then you come to verse 24. Most blessed of women is Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Most blessed is she of women in the tent. Do you think that that is an incredibly true statement? You think about Deborah was incredibly brave. How brave was Jael? Incredible bravery and faith. I think when you think of Jael, what other women of the Bible do you think of as kind of a similar type of bravery, I think you can say, that was displayed? You think about Esther. Who else?
I think of Jochebed.
Jochebed.
Moses' mother.
Yes, you all studied that in the women's study. Yes. Who else? Rahab. I think of Rahab. I was talking to Pac Sunday. He thought of Abigail. I mean, there's a lot of women who have taken the initiative, put their neck out there, you could say, risked their lives, risked a lot of things to serve God and to do what was right. And she definitely put herself out there in a very difficult situation and took the initiative. When you have all these other people who are being passive and all these other people who wouldn't volunteer and all these other people that wouldn't do it, she takes the tent peg and she does it herself. And I think she made the opportunity. If you remember, she's the one that was like, come into my tent and did all these things. And there are some interesting statements. I mean, obviously, this statement of most blessed of women is Jael, and most blessed of women is she in the tent. That's all very true. But also, you look at verses 25 through 27, and it's a retelling of what we read in chapter 4, with just a few, I think, extra things added here, a little more detail. First of all, why did Jael give Sisera curds in a magnificent bowl? When Dale was teaching chapter 4, we talked a little bit about this, about how he asked for water. He's weary from running from the battle, and he asked for water, and she gives him milk. Why here, it goes into more detail and says that she gave him a magnificent bowl. She brought him curds. Why would she have done that? Boring. Yes. That's a great word for it. That's right. Yeah, she's showing. She was acting as if she's giving respect to him.
Uh huh.
That's right. Yeah, it's kind of like someone who's fishing, you know, and she's casting it out there and she's trying to set the hook. Yeah, she's doing all these things and like the bait is out there, and so the way she acted at the tent to get him to come in, and obviously I'm sure he thought he was at a safe place. And from everything we read, he should have been in a safe place. Heber and Jabin, they had a connection with the king of Canaan. He should have been in a comfortable place there with her. And the way she acted, and then bringing him milk instead of water, it says here it was curds. It's in a magnificent bowl. She's showing some respect or maybe reverence to him in some way. She brings out a blanket and a rug or something to cover him up so he can rest. Everything sounds really good for Sisera up to that point until he falls asleep. Yeah. And so we have the detail here. It talks about that a little bit. But we know what happened, of how she was brave enough to take a tent peg and kill Sisera, kill the commander of the Canaanite army. What great bravery. What great bravery by this woman to take the initiative to do that and act in faith. It's pretty incredible. Does anyone have any statements or anything you want to add to this about Jael or anything here? Uh-huh.
This was somebody who probably put a tent, taken them down with her husband, as being nomads and traveling and things. This wasn't any really easy task. I don't know how many people drink tent pegs, but I make Pax do a little show from
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. Yes. Yeah, and that's right. We do know that God had a hand and how it was revealed that it would be by the hand of a woman, that there would be glory to a woman in this case. But you're right, on her part too, most blessed of women is Jael. And it's very, very righteous and true to do what she did. Uh-huh. Any other comments we want to add? Uh-huh, Pax. Or praise. It's not my job. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, and you're right. She's recorded for all time. Most blessed of women. And that's an amazing thing, a legacy that she left, for sure. All right. Let's look at verses 28 through 31. In verses 28 through 31, we get an interesting flip side. So we just read of Sisera's killed by Jael. Now it switches over to what would the mindset or the perception be from Sisera's mother's point of view. And that's really interesting to think about. So in verse 28 we read, "Out of the window she looked and lamented, the mother of Sisera through the lattice. Why does his chariot delay coming? Why do the hoofbeats of his chariot tarry? Her wise princesses would answer her. Indeed she repeats her words to herself. Are they not finding? Are they not dividing the spoil? A maiden, two maidens for every warrior. To Sisera, a spoil of dyed work. A spoil of dyed work embroidered. Dyed work of double embroidery on the neck of the spoiler. Thus let all your enemies perish, O Lord. And let those who love him be like the rising of the sun in its might. And the land was undisturbed for 40 years. So here as you get to the conclusion and the end of this song, it definitely shifts to an interesting perspective of the mother of Sisera. And you could say it's a grieving mother. It says that Sisera's mother is lamenting. But she doesn't know at the point when this is stated here whether or not her son is... She doesn't know if he's dead. She hasn't gotten the news that Sisera has perished. And so it states that she's looking out the lattice. She's looking out of a window. She's wondering why Sisera has not returned. Why has the commander of the Canaanite army not come back yet? He should be back by now. Where is he? And so she's looking for her son. And she's concerned. She says, why are the chariots late in coming? Why do the hoofbeats of his chariots tarry? And then her words go on in verse 30 to start naming specific things for maybe the possible delay. And it's pointing out, I think, from the perspective that's kind of honest. Was Sisera probably a very successful commander? Probably. I mean, he's got 900 iron chariots, and you know, and they've been reigning pretty well, you know, in this area. And the sons of Israel have been highly oppressed. So I think she's like, you know, well, it must be that, you know, there's just been great plunder you know? And so what's happening here is that maybe they're delayed because they're finding the spoil, a maiden or two maidens for every warrior. There's dyed work and embroidery that they're gathering. Do you think maybe even Sisera's mother got things from him that when he returned from battle? Yeah, maybe he had found some embroidered things or found some gifts, and he would bring it to his mother, possibly. And so she's looking out, wondering, where is he? And she's trying to reason with the possibilities and thinking, well, you know, it must have been fine. They must have been victorious, and they're just going through the spoil, right? She's trying to ease her mind, although it says that she was obviously lamenting. So this perspective of Sisera's mother shows, you know, her trying to reason why her son would not be there at this time. And she's longing for her son. And it's her son that would never return. She would never see her son again. Yes, Doug?
Keep in mind what we saw from the previous chapter. Not only was Sisera not coming back, but nobody's
coming back. No, they took out all of them. That's right. That whole army was destroyed. That's right. All the men are going to be to perish. That's right. And so I think it's just an interesting kind of shift there that's added at the end of the psalm, that you get a little bit of that perspective of Sisera's mother. It makes you, in some ways, feel for Sisera's mother, I guess, maybe. Do you feel any emotional attachment there? Maybe you do as a parent. But at the same time, what is the next thing that's said at the beginning of verse 31? Thus let all your enemies perish, O Lord. I don't think Deborah and Barak feel a whole lot of sympathy for Sisera's mother. Do you? No. This is an enemy of the Lord. And so it's mentioned, that perspective is mentioned, but this is an enemy of the Lord. And this was the Lord's will, that Sisera should perish. And so let all of your enemies perish, O Lord. There in verse 31, after that it reads, but let those who love him be like the rising of the sun and its might. That's a very beautiful passage there. To think about the enemies of the Lord, they perished back then. In the book of Judges, the enemies perished. Is it still the same today that the enemies of the Lord will perish? Yes. You know, and we can think about, I was wrong today, or you were wrong today, or somebody did this to me, or somebody did that to me, or in our world this is happening, or that's happening. Will the enemies of the Lord in the end perish? Yes. But on the other hand, those who love God, those who love the Lord, are going to be like the rising of the sun in its might. It's a beautiful passage. We're going to look at that more in just a second. But the last statement that we get in at the end of chapter 5 is that the land was undisturbed for 40 years. We see the cycle restarting as you're about to get into Gideon, where there's a time of peace, and then we're going to have what happened next. They're going to fall away and be evil. And then they're going to do what? Cry out to the Lord. And then what's the Lord going to do? Bring a deliverer, bring a judge. And then what's going to happen? They're going to be delivered. And then there's going to be a time of peace. And then we can see the pattern, right? It's a cycle. And I think this is all recorded for us because God doesn't want us to fall into that cycle. God doesn't want us as Christians to be the cycle. The cycle is terrible. Can we be the cycle? Yes. I'm living righteously. I'm doing what God wants me to do. I've become a Christian. I'm serving God. I fall away. My life gets terrible. I'm dealing with the ramifications of my sin. Okay, I'm going to repent. Great. I get back on track. I'm righteous. Here we go again. Don't do the cycle. Don't do the cycle. Love the Lord and be like the rising of the sun. He wants consistency from his people. He always has. It was like that for the book of Judges. It's like that for you and I. He wants consistency. Will we fail? Yes. Will we sin? We'll make mistakes. Yes. But he wants consistency. He expects consistency. And he deserves consistency. Consistent faithfulness to the Lord. And that's what we see here in the book of Judges in the grand scheme of as we go about to go into Gideon. I wanted to put this picture up here. This final proclamation of God, praising God. But I found a picture of a sunset, and I thought this last passage here is just so beautiful that let those who love him be like the rising of the sun in its might. I know when the time change, some of us dread the time change. It's getting dark, you know, so much earlier and things like that, which a lot of us don't enjoy necessarily. But so we have had some beautiful sunrises over the last couple of weeks. It's been a little cloudy the last few days, but last week we had some of the most beautiful sunrises. And you're driving to work, you're outside, and you see the sun rising, and it just makes you just go, thank you, God. I mean, I don't know. It just instantly makes me want to proclaim God's praises. It is that beautiful and that amazing that God has made everything perfectly like this. So beautiful. And this passage connects so well with thinking about those that love God will be like the rising of the sun. What a beautiful picture. What a beautiful thing to think about. Is there anything you all would like to add as we conclude chapter 5, the Song of Deborah and Barak?
Mm-hmm. They've had 20 years where they've been in the rule.
Yeah.
And Israel has been oppressed. And you make it, especially the last part that she's reading there, about the spoils and the plunder and everything like that. She's thinking about what she's going to get. And you talk about, you know, why is he so late or dang? It really doesn't say. Mm-hmm. So they've had 20 years where he's been.
No problem.
Dead.
That's right.
And, you know, and so from that standpoint, she may be looking at standpoint or step calling is what is he going to bring her, and that reason you see the list there of things that the good things that he is going to probably bring her. That's the reason why he's slain.
That's right. That's right. That's a great point. I agree. Yeah.
Compared to the other women, I don't see her as being that great as a woman that is concerned about her son and things more. She's concerned about herself. She's had 20 years.
That's right. Yeah. And I think it also reminds me of that you have people who have committed just terrible, despicable crimes where a son has done awful, awful, awful things. And you have a mother that will love them unconditionally. You know what I mean? And be in their corner through whatever. And they could just do it. It doesn't matter what, you know. It reminds me a little bit of that today, that you have some people who are like that. I know that's a little off topic, but you have people who are like that today, where a person is, a son is just absolutely terrible, but because it's the role of a mother, then that motherly love always trumps the behavior of the child. It reminds me of that a little bit. Pax?
It's not just about the beauty of it. It's, to me, it's about the power of the sun and the energy. Let them be like the sun. Mm-hmm. And this is a blessing to those who are righteous. And the terminology that's used, the words that are used in Psalm 1, there, the latter part of verse 2, it says, and whatever he does will prosper from that sun that is planted by the rivers of water. They'll produce and they'll be strong. It says, whatever he does.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, the song is full of acknowledging people who put their might and their faith in God and acted in great faith. That's right. Do we have any other comments? Okay. On Sunday, we'll begin in chapter 6. Dale will be starting looking at a little bit about Gideon, getting into our next judge. Okay? All right. Thank you all very much for your discussion. I appreciate it.